Welcome back one and all to another episode here at the Dameron Report. Still a big news Wednesday, although J.R. Jackson is off doing his own thing. He actually just got off doing his own thing a few minutes ago, literally at this desk. But although he might not be here, we do have someone who's both special, also a throwback to the early days of the Dameron Report. Dan Evans returns. Dan, how's it going?
I am doing great. I'm also a throwback to 4 minutes ago when I was on JR's show, but you are far better than my sloppy seconds, John Iderola. I'm so happy to be on the show.
That was a compliment, and yet I regret it anyway. But anyway, yes, for the few who might not be sticking around from the watch list, and they might not be familiar with you, you do an incredible amount of work that is not on this show or the watch list. Can you tell us a little bit about your work?
Yeah, so recently I've been hosting Good Morning Bad News on TikTok. You can check us out at Good Morning Bad News on TikTok. We wrap up the worst news stories in the world and some really fun social justice things and leftist things in a really short amount of time. So check us out there. And also I do podcasts where I get into various amounts of trouble, Power Report on politics and Audio Face on music stuff. So just follow me on Twitter, Dan from the Web, and get it all.
Nice. Yes, that is actually my favorite TikTok show. And that is not just because there's not a lot of competition, because I don't do TikTok, but it is very, very high quality. I've enjoyed all of your videos on there, so everyone should definitely go check it out. What else can you check out? Well, you can check out a ton of news that we're going to be running down through the course of the next 90 minutes or so. We're going to be talking about war, and we got other stuff, student loan debts and SCOTUS picks and the New York Times and Whoopi Goldberg. I mean, those are pretty much the things that the topics we hit every day. We're going to be hitting them today as well. Oh, also, we're going to be taking a brief trip back to Grift Nation because some of you out there might be very worried about COVID and you want to know what you can take to make yourself more healthy. Obviously, the vaccine is out. That's what Bill Gates wants you to take. So we found a new thing that you can inject into your body. So that's going to be very, very exciting. Also wanted to let you know, small news, sort of thing we would normally do on the pre-show, which we'll have an announcement about the pre-show later this week. Punxsutawney Phil predicts 6 more weeks of winter, Dan. Are you worried about that? Are you disappointed that we're going to have more cold weather?
Well, considering we live in California in the year 2022, I don't think we're ever getting cold weather again. So we're going to have to recalibrate these gophers or whatever we've got, groundhogs.
That's true. Although I have to admit, and I mostly say this to frustrate everyone not watching in Southern California, my hands are a little bit cold today, so I feel your pain.
Yeah, I'm indoors and you're actually going to see I do a little bit of a costume change into a jacket, even though I'm indoors. Mm-hmm. It's a little strange, but you know, we adapt to climate change here.
We do, that's what we're doing. Anyway, with that said, Dan, are you ready to talk about some news?
Born ready.
Because that, yeah, you're reliable. I knew. We had you on when you were one and you were already great. Anyway, with that said, by the way, hit the like button, share the stream, all that stuff. And with that said, let's talk about this. I don't think anyone thinks that a war between the US and Russia, whether direct or via proxies, is a good idea, but every day the news looks worse and worse. Not necessarily in a way that's going to lead to actual direct conflict, but we're sure going to spend a lot of money getting ready for one. Anyway, the updates we have now in terms of what's going on around the whole Ukraine issue is that Joe Biden has announced the US is going to be deploying thousands of troops in Germany, Poland, and Romania as they also officially acknowledge the Russian buildup outside of Ukraine for the first time. So Joe Biden sending about 2,000 US-based troops to Poland and Germany and shifting roughly 1,000 additional soldiers from Germany to Romania as demonstrations of American commitments to NATO allies. And so you send some to Germany, you take some out of Germany. It's a fun little musical chairs thing we're gonna do. That is, of course, in addition to the earlier deployment of 8,500 troops in the US, including airborne units being put on heightened alert. They're going to be part of a NATO response force intended to bolster the alliance's eastern flank. So, by the way, like, this is obviously significant. Let's bear this in mind, but let's also bear in mind that the US has standing military forces in basically every corner of the world, including 75 to 80,000 troops in Europe specifically, just in general. So it is more troops and they are being moved and it's being said to be about this, but there are always a lot of American troops in Europe. So that said, Dan, we haven't spoken since this whole thing flared up. What are your thoughts?
It's really unfortunate that I've just started keeping track of this since I started doing my own political show, but it feels like every January or February begins with the United States almost getting into some conflict. Like we had Iran a couple of years ago and under multiple different presidents. It's like a new year, new war. It's one of our New Year's resolutions. But as with all of this coverage, war coverage and American media is often just parroting what the administration at any given time is saying. So I'm looking at coverage in a lot of other different places and I'm seeing what the situation is like on the ground in Ukraine. And in Ukraine, you have citizens who are training with wooden guns, essentially, who are getting ready to fight and take up arms against like the Russians in this situation. So it's definitely very tense here that the fact that you have individuals who are wanting to take up arms as well in that way. But I'm not feeling really good about the need, as a lot of folks are, the need for the United States to continue to ramp up tensions in this situation when we know that Vladimir Putin seems to be very intent on creating chaos and destabilization around Ukraine. So I don't know if like Joe Biden, if it's smart for us to be playing into this game so much. That being said, of course, we have sanctions that you'll probably be getting into in a moment that also surround the matter, but it's definitely very tense right now.
Yeah, well, yeah, sanctions are definitely a part of it. It really does feel like, at least from the US point of view, this is, I don't know, 10%, 20% about the relationship with Ukraine and the potential future for Ukraine that many people are like condensing down to, well, they were going to be in NATO next week. So I know the whole thing is just really weird in that respect. But yes, there's the likelihood of sanctions against Russia, against individual members of Putin's administration, against Putin himself. There's also a ton of money that is going to be spent here, or weapons that are going to be bought and sent to Ukraine or other allies in the region. Like that is a guarantee regardless of what else happens. But I also, I have to be honest about what I think is likely to happen. And like, the people who are like, especially in Fox News, who are like, Biden wants war with Putin. I don't think that he wants to fight Russia. I don't think that that's true. And they're continuing to reiterate that they're not sending forces actually into Ukraine. So what it feels like is happening is they want to reassure NATO, obviously. They want to send signals or whatever to Russia, but they're also not going to send soldiers into Ukraine and get into some sort of actual direct conflict. I don't know if or when Russia is likely to or not invade Ukraine, but I also don't think that they sent over 100,000 troops just for the fun of it. In theory, they could move in to either permanently or at least temporarily invade Ukraine and then use the position that they have to sort of barter for a better domestic political position inside of Ukraine that could benefit Russia in the future. I don't want any of this, but you know, Dan, we're progressives. What the hell does it matter what we want?
Yeah, of course, being progressives, our opinions on foreign policy and war are completely irrelevant, except for when the Democratic Party wants votes. And so the main thing with this that I'm concerned about is that, listen, kind of like what you were saying, John, the United States after World War II just has military bases everywhere. And so whenever there are these kinds of conflicts, there's a whole song and dance where America says, hey, Russia or China or whatever large superpower it is at the time, usually, we're going to move our people towards you. And so don't get aggressive or anything because we're ready to act. It's a show of war and strength. And sure, in war games, high politics, people do these things. But it's been many, many decades of America playing world police. And we see at home the American government is very incapable of managing and handling a number of different things. That being said, that's because we spend so much of our tax money every single year on the war machine. But I'm not necessarily certain that our war incursions or anything like that are that much better. And so what I worry about, I don't think this is going to happen, but this is just where my brain goes, is if this escalates to some type of conflict and all the NATO forces, all of the lethal aid, because that's the Orwellian term we're using now, is like, isn't as effective as they thought it would be or figured it would be. And so you start to actually see on a larger world sense, this crushing of this idea that, oh, America can just go around the world and do whatever they want to. They'll show up and win the day. Mm-hmm. If it seems like America's weaker in these situations, then other countries, Russia and China, are going to just take advantage of that weakness. And I'm not a person who is for China bashing or let's get into war with these countries that are just capitalists like the United States. There's no real reason to do this. But I am worried about, once war starts and snowballs, it's hard to kind of de-escalate it. And so these things concern me, but I'm hoping, like you're saying, John, that Joe Biden doesn't want in a midterm election year for an unpopular war to begin when he just got some credit, about a lot of heat, for winding down things in Afghanistan.
And look, like for all of our accumulated thoughts and views about the military industrial complex, its historic relationship to the US government, the current iteration of that, a war would benefit that, but they also don't need a war. They could just have a really tense situation with Russia that results in us spending a few years spending hundreds of millions of additional dollars every single year. You don't actually have to go to war for that. We are perfectly willing to. Obviously that has been clear in the Middle East, but I think it's far less likely that that Biden is like secretly pining for a hot war with Russia than, you know, the US wanted to finally get in and do what it wanted to do to Iraq. I just don't think those are exactly the same situation. Although financially it could end up looking similar. Now, really fast, I want to jump through just a couple of other updates. Vladimir Putin said just yesterday that the US was trying to pull Russia into an armed conflict over Ukraine. Again, saying that that's not what Russia wants. Again, I don't think that's what Biden wants. But anyway, he says their most important task is to contain Russia's development. Ukraine is just an instrument of achieving this goal. It can be done in different ways, such as pulling us into some armed conflict and then forcing their allies in Europe to enact those harsh sanctions against us that are being discussed today in the United States. Well, let's say that hypothetically that was the plot, that Biden secretly did want Russia to invade Ukraine so that they could then deploy these sanctions. If you're identifying it as that, I know one easy way not to fall into it. Don't invade. I mean, you could not have those soldiers there. And I get it. It's not like if I'm trying to put myself into the Russian point of view, I mean, their regime, not their actual people, because I think there's a vast gulf there, that in theory they think they can just stay in their borders and everything will be great or whatever. But let's also not pretend that Vladimir Putin is just a purely rational political leader who is doing what he thinks is best for his people and the economic future of the country, disconnected from his own personal economic interests. So I don't like or believe literally anyone in this story. I mean, Dan's cool. I like Dan. But other than Dan, all of these quotes are such BS.
I will let the generals know that you don't like them, John. And we'll see how that reacts. Two words, predator drones. You won't see a con.
They'd never do that domestically. Anyway, little other tidbits of news. Josh Hawley is calling on Biden to drop support for Ukraine membership in NATO, which is like, it's acknowledged as being outside of the norm of what most establishment GOP senators are pushing for, but seems pretty much in line with the Tucker Carlson emerging wing of the party, which has this weird thing about Russia. So like, Hawley's gotta seem to be in support of what they want. Again, the NATO like membership thing for Ukraine was not a thing that was on the horizon. Why is everyone pretending that that was a thing that was gonna happen in June or whatever? I don't know. And by the way, I wanna give a little bit of credit, not substantive credit, but just posturing credit to Poland for one-upping Germany in their present of 5,000 helmets being sent to Ukraine. Poland's like, oh yeah, helmets, they're cool, but what about shoulder fired anti-aircraft missiles? Again, not helping the tension in the situation sending those, but it looks tougher. I'll give them that. If that's what they're going for, I think they achieved it.
Lethal aid.
Lethal aid. You know, there's so much that I don't know about Ukraine. I feel like the hundreds of millions of dollars or whatever could be better spent there. I feel like the Russian people could have gotten more for their money than whatever it's costing to garrison 100+ thousand troops right outside the border of Ukraine. And I damn sure know in the US context that we could have done better with the money than what we're gonna choose to, on top of our already, you know, incredible military budget. Anyway, any final thoughts?
No, I worry we've had too many thoughts about this first story.
I think that we probably have. Okay, with that said, we're gonna take our first break. When we come back though, some in Congress are pushing for student loan debt cancellation, but are they doing it for the reason they say? The New York Post has a theory and we'll present it to you after this. Okay, buddy, let's talk about some more news.
Let's go.
You've probably heard about the debate about student loan debt cancellation. We talk about it a lot here. Politicians have made promises saying that they would do that. Hey, Joe Biden's one of those. And there have been politicians like Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who's pictured beside me, who has made a big deal out of this issue over the past few years. Now, if you were to ask the Congresswoman, she would say that she's doing that because many people are burdened by student loan debt. It's horrible, it hurts the economy, it certainly hurts their life prospects. But is that actually why she and other members of the so-called squad are pushing for it? Well, the New York Times has a different theory, and it's not quite so philanthropic. So they have this is, by the way, this is not an op-ed. This is a news article on the New York Post. These woke polls want student loans forgiven, including their own. Many of the woke politicians who have pushed for student loan cancellation are themselves hip deep in school debt. Federal records reviewed by the Post show most members of the squad, the coterie of socialist legislators. Again, this is not an op-ed. This is news. Socialist legislators led by Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez fall into this category. Collectively, they owe between $180,000 and $400,000 in student loan debt. And it's not just her. They have this big picture of Ilhan Omar. Did you know Ilhan Omar has student loan debt? Ocasio-Cortez has between $15,000 and $50,000. Representative Jamal Bowman has a loan debt balance between $100,000 and $250,000. And critics say that student loans present a potential conflict for lawyers in the ongoing debate of whether they should be reduced or forgiven. So Dan, they make it seem as if they want to help out millions of people with student loan debt. But is it really just about clearing their $15,000 in debt?
A politician getting elected to help themselves. We never see this in the Republican Party. We never see this in the Democratic Party. We've never seen this with any kind of politician at all. We only see this with this. Again, I want to subvert this entire argument, because the right argument to make is, of course, this isn't student debt relief for a small segment of Democratic House representatives. If so, it would have passed fairly quickly. It's student debt relief for a number of different Americans. Like, it would help tons of people, even if it were up to $50,000, which, as I've argued on TikTok at Good Morning Bad News, there's no legal precedent that says Joe Biden can't just wipe out all of the student loan debt with a stroke of a pen. He has, Congress has given him the approval to do it, so those arguments make no sense. But no, John, I'm gonna take the argument that yes, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ilhan Omar and Jamal Bowman and whoever should be fighting for student loans selfishly. Not only because it will help other people, but because every single politician is elected in office to fight for themselves selfishly and to get themselves deals. That makes no difference, okay? Like Nancy Pelosi is doing insider trading. Joe Manchin is getting deals he can and blocking climate change proposals so that he can have people in West Virginia who are coal lobbyists, who he has like as part of his financial mix, benefit from that as well, okay? So why can't the New York Post get off of stop writing the squad for fighting for student debt relief? Like,
exactly.
Like, as every single politician does some form of self-dealing. This isn't self-dealing, but what if it is? It would be great for the rest of us.
Yeah, I and let's be clear, I don't think that that's why they're pushing for it. Like, Yeah, AOC has made a years-long thing about this because of the 15 to 50,000 that she could say. Okay, maybe. And by the way, you know who would be like the first that would be willing to carve a totally stupid and pointless carve out where they wouldn't be affected by it? Literally every member of the squad, I'm sure, would be happy to do it. It's the dumbest thing ever and they shouldn't have to. But this ain't about that. This is about the New York Post trying desperately and comically to get you to think that some of the few politicians who literally ever try to do something to benefit other people who aren't already wealthy are actually secretly the most corrupt at all. Because why is AOC pushing for the ban on individual stock trading? I mean, if you think she wants the $15,000, she could certainly use the position she has on all these committees to make a lot more money than that. And they actually draw a comparison to it. They quote this guy, Representative Scott Perry, to say, "I certainly do think it presents a conflict of interest, and I don't know how anybody can realistically tell me how this is essentially different from insider trading. The important thing is that number one, they made a commitment, and number two, debt cancellation would personally enrich them." Well, first of all, along the whole thing about the insider trading is that allowing them to do it allows them to be uniquely benefited. They're the only ones that have access to the information that's being presented to them. Whereas the student loan debt cancellation would be equal. It would be, yes, they might benefit, but millions of other people would too. It is such a stupid, stupid argument. And do you think that Scott Perry actually is willing to ban individual stock ownership? Maybe. I would love to see that. But this is just it is such an obvious, transparent, backhanded way to try to get the very people who would benefit from student loan debt cancellation to turn against the policy and turn against the politicians who are fighting for that.
Yeah, I'm gonna just graphic jump you, but like the outstanding federal loan portfolio is over $1.61 trillion. Like if you just made it so people don't have to spend $1.6 trillion on their debt, essentially. The average student loan balance is $34,000. Imagine if the average person had $37,000 less debt. That money could be spent in the economy. That money could be spent for people getting houses or getting places better to live. Just so much could be done by unlocking that economic potential. But no, that's the same as insider trading and trading off of backroom deals. It kind of shows you the disconnect on a class level between a lot of these politicians and regular everyday people.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. It affects so many different people. So many. 43 million borrowers. No, but let's focus on those five. Let's focus on those five. Okay, so you cited the 1.61 trillion. What percentage is the squad's debt of that 1.61 trillion? Could we even write it out? Would it even register as a number? Maybe, but no. Let's follow the post. Let's not do anything about this, and it'll probably be fine. It'll probably work itself out. I mean, if you look at historic total student loan debt, there's a lot of reason to believe that this is just going to correct itself. If we want to take a look at that chart, it's just going to get worse and worse. And this is not. And by the way, like the canceling thing, like you pointed out, there's no reason why it should be limited to 10,000 or 50,000. People act as if it's in the Constitution that they can cancel 10,000 or something. And this is federally backed student loan debt. There is still going to be some that is totally privately held that they're not going to touch. But there is so much that is held by the US government. And the same people who are constantly thinking that the US government should weigh in to benefit individual industries, whether it's pharma giving them protections from regulations, protection from negotiation, or huge amounts of money being pumped into the military industrial complex, or the bailing out of big banks and auto companies. Well, no, we can't touch the debt companies, clearly. That's the one thing that's still sacred and holy in the US government. Anyway, any other thoughts?
Only that the New York Post has no thoughts left at all.
Yeah. And by the way, as I've said many times on the show, because I lived effectively the life of a hermit for years and years and put every dollar I could in my student loan debt, thankfully, I was lucky enough to be able to clear it out. So New York Post, do I get to advocate for it? It wouldn't personally benefit me. Checkmate, Postie. I get to say it. Anyway, it's so stupid. If AOC were to pay off her debt tomorrow, will you suddenly change your mind about student loan debt cancellation? What a waste of paper. Anyway, more ridiculous attacks, this time coming from people inside of the party, theoretically. Let's jump into this video.
Identity is just the starting step when we are discussing a Supreme Court justice.
So that is a video of Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez talking about the ongoing conversation about what should drive President Biden's choice for the justice on the Supreme Court that will fill Breyer's seat when he steps down. Now, she had more to say, which we'll get to, but that's the part that everyone is focusing on. Because if you just focus on that, then you can pretend that AOC doesn't care about representation and in fact goes further than that and hates black women, because that is the attacks that's coming at her and others who think that representation matters. But inside of that rubric, you can also have considerations for what they would do as judges. So the recount, which had a video that went viral of her saying that, and they, I like the recount, but they ellipsed out some very important parts of this that we'll get to in a bit, was followed by comments saying the anti-blackness is just appalling. Disappointment is about addressing systemic inequities and acknowledging them. She doesn't get to change the narrative about this. Or Tulsi Gabbard and AOC have more in common than they think. They both hate to see black women thriving. Or funny how the media and journalists don't seem to notice what is so damned obvious to black folks, that she is anti-black. We're gonna get to the rest of her argument there. But Dan, this is the first that we've been able to have you wanna talk about the fact that this Supreme Court seat has opened up. What are your thoughts?
Now, my overall thoughts with the Supreme Court seat pick is that I would appreciate for Joe Biden to pick a black woman for Supreme Court pick, not only because there are a number of black women who are qualified for this, but because this is one of the few campaign promises that would be a layup for him to make. My questions with this is that I feel like the Biden administration would just go, hey, we picked a black woman, and then they would say that we've done enough for black people, and then they would come and try to get their votes, when he's still coming off of "you ain't black." Kamala Harris is still coming off of Charlemagne the God grilling her on the very obvious fact that Joe Manchin seems to be doing a lot more leadership legislatively in the United States than Joe Biden does. And so there is this flavor on within the Democratic Party of for a lot of people who see the representation as simply being enough, that Kamala Harris is vice president, therefore things are being done for black people, or yeah, we have a black Supreme Court justice, therefore, or yeah, a black woman Supreme Court justice, therefore things are being done for black women. And yes, that's very important. Yes, it's very important in the Supreme Court, but we as progressives, we as Democrats have to raise our standards and say, it's not enough to just have black faces in high spaces. You have to actually be doing the actions and doing the work that makes sure that the black faces that aren't in high spaces, the people of color, everyone overall in the country has access to equal rights and fairness the best we can. And there are a lot of Democrats who don't do that even. And so that's where the pushback kind of comes from.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I also agree with your concerns about Biden, that look, there have been, you know, any number of different women. Even if you just cut the list down to black women who might be nominees that are certainly qualified objectively, but also do vary in terms of what they would probably use the position for. And so AOC is not saying don't consider black women. As we'll get to in just a minute, she is very much saying too, but that, okay, we're gonna do that. Now let's also get into their judicial philosophy. The replies to her make it seem as if, no, it's out of bounds to also consider that, but I don't even think that that's what they mean. I think these are people who, on some level, probably a somewhat shallow level, care about representation and want it, but also love the idea that the status quo of the Supreme Court is maintained and aren't particularly interested in getting some sort of strong progressive judge or something like that. But anyway, before we continue, let's get to the full commentary of what she said.
There is no shortage of incredible, qualified, leading black female candidates to serve on the Supreme Court. But the question is, what is going to be that nominee's worldview? And what I hope is that what we see is a nominee that is truly rooted in not just public service, but with a protection towards the very rights that frankly have been eroded over the last, not just, you know, 2, 3, 5 years, but the last 10 years.
Yeah, so it's not an either or, it's an and. And like that we shouldn't have to have a debate about whether someone's substance also matters. That should go without saying. Like, how long have we been having this fight online that, like, you know, the goal shouldn't just be getting more girl bosses to pull the trigger to fire a predator, you know, missile. Like, that's not what the goal is supposed to be. It's supposed to be representation and change. And she's being very clear about that. The attacks are insane. So what could she be alluding to? I don't know specifically in terms of the nominees, but we have been getting more information from some great reporting from people like David Dayan of The Prospect about Michelle Childs is one of the considerations. And obviously these are people that have done hundreds of decisions. There's a lot there to go through. But in that reporting on The Prospect, Alexander Salmon reveals that Michelle Childs has worked for years defending employers accused in racial, gender, and other discrimination cases. As recently as this year, she dismissed a case where an employee alleged she was sexually harassed, subjected to a hostile work environment, and subsequently fired upon reporting it. And David Dayan points out she's notable for several tough on crime rulings that were so out of step legally that they were later overturned by higher courts. These are all things to bear in mind. They are not reasons to then say, well, then screw it, let's just put Ted Cruz on the Supreme Court. But these are women who have histories that can and should be looked at and will be. And we get to decide based on the content. Well, we don't get to, but it will be decided on the content there. What effect would they actually have on the Supreme Court, and then choose accordingly from them?
Yeah, it's a moment, like a thought on AOC. Like, it's difficult with her because you'll have on the right wing, we just did a story about how the New York Post will smear what she's doing and label her as corrupt. And on the left wing, and many parts of the left, you'll have people saying that, oh, AOC is anti-black. And then you'll go even further on the left and say AOC is a sellout to the moderates in the center who she's getting crap from all the time. And she's not a perfect politician. I criticize her on a number of different things where she should go much harder, or whether she isn't going like hard enough, and like, yeah, in those different ways. But you got to understand that in a lot of these ways, when you just pay attention to the context of what she's saying, I am of the opinion that she is more often than not really trying to fight for people and really has the right head on her shoulders and is speaking to what us progressives, not in Washington, D.C. every day, are concerned about and giving those a voice in Washington, D.C. And so I continue to be grateful and appreciative of that, because there's a lot of other ways everywhere where she's getting media criticism, and I will give her criticism when it's due and when it's deserved. But like, this is just one of those moments where I'm glad that she is there, and I'm glad that Justice Democrats and all the people TYT involved and otherwise helped to get her elected so that voice can be there.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. The only, I'm gonna have to figure out what that comment is. The only minor thing I would disagree with you on is that people more on the left are attacking for that reason. I understand that's how they would present this, but I don't think being more vicious to left politicians makes you more leftist yourself. I think that's a trap that they want us to fall into. But I agree. Fair. Yes, and it's largely a thankless task when you're, and not just AOC. Like, AOC was the one who said this comment, but it's the sort of argument that would get Rashida Tlaib attacked and Ilhan Omar attacked and Jamal Bowman attacked and all that, because they probably believe similar things. It is largely a thankless task. You do get attacked from pretty much every direction. And that does not mean that you are perfect or flawless, so that we can't disagree with you, as Dan points out. When it's appropriate, it should definitely but in any event, we'll have to see. I think that it is likely that on this list, some of the potential nominees, I haven't yet seen anything that seems like a massive deal breaker. For others, it's a little bit more of a mixed case. It is Joe Biden, so you can probably guess which of those we're gonna end up getting. Anyway, okay, with that said, we're gonna take the second break of our first hour. When we come back though, we've got some news, a little bit that the New York Times would probably like you to be thinking about, and a little bit that they probably would not be. As well as Lindsey Graham, he's gonna be repaid for his loyalty to Donald Trump. All that and more after this. Okay, everybody, it's time for some unfun. Let's talk about it. We've got big news this week about the New York Times. They've acquired Wordle. The game that you either put a few fun, intense moments into every day, or you're just really sick of people tweeting about it. They've acquired it. from its creator, Joshua Wardle, software engineer in Brooklyn, for a price in the low seven figures. The company said the game would initially remain free to play and existing players would be able to. It was originally back on November 1st, it had 90 users. That number grew to 300,000 by the middle of this month. And now millions play the game daily. And that will continue up until they put a paywall in front of it, and then you will never hear about it again. So good job, New York Times. But we're just joking, that's not what the news is about. That's what the New York Times would probably like you to be thinking about in terms of them this week, and probably not their ongoing approach to the unionization effort inside of the New York Times. So last April, 650 different tech employees at the New York Times announced that they were unionizing. The company initially refused to voluntarily recognize the union. This is despite its own editorial board supporting a bill that would have made it legally binding for employers to voluntarily accept union requests when they're backed by a majority of the staff. So they didn't recognize it. And my instinct is to say behind the scenes, but behind the scenes is really sort of a slippery slope there, have been very clear about their approach and have tried to influence the effort all along. Internal documents as well as Slack messages that have been obtained by The Guardian reveal that senior executives at the New York Times have been putting pressure on workers to vote no in the union election. One, the actual CEO, Meredith Kopit-Levien, wrote a memo on the 19th of January, circulated a staff titled "Why a Tech Union Isn't Right for Us" on the Tech Union's Tech Workers Union Election at X Fund, the group within the New York Times responsible for product development operations, saying, quote, "In short, we don't believe unionizing in X Fund is the right move, but that's not because I'm anti-union." And then there's a bunch of others that we can get to, but Dan, I'm sure that you're not surprised that this is the approach they're taking, but I am surprised that considering how big New York Times is, that it's not a bigger story.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because when you get these stories that are about the media itself, you start to see like the power of media and how, oh, this is a New York Times story about New York Times workers starting to realize their own worker power. We're not going to cover that. Like, it's going to be very hard to have that departmental conversation, even though they claim to, in so many other places, say, oh, we protect against bias. We make sure our journalists don't have to practice bias or anything like that. So these are all institutions that exist for whatever reason. But it is kind of shameful, absolutely shameful, that the New York Times is trying to have this double standard on around recognizing the unionization efforts of the New York Times reporters. I believe the New York Times tech part of their vertical is Wirecutter, and they're just doing nothing but making, like not to plug them, but they're just doing nothing but reviewing tech products all the time and gadgets and giving reviews for those things. As with any job in media, it's a lot of work, and the people who deserve it deserve to be represented in their workplaces. And so it's important for people who care about like the New York Times and the Wirecutter and what they're doing here to make some of the noise that the workers themselves may feel pressured against doing because of the situation that their workplace is. Their jobs might be on the line here. So that's something I take away from the story.
Definitely. I have more to say. Let me give you a little bit more examples of some of the pressure that's been put. So a leaflet was distributed by the Times for workers to read that said, "We encourage you to vote no." It cited three reasons. So the first is weakening relationships between employees and managers. What is the relationship supposed to be? Like, less, is it gonna be less chummy? Is it less pally? The second is lengthy negotiating processes and inflexible multi-year agreements. And the third is reducing your flexibility to learn new skills. And so look, I've heard those sorts of arguments before. It's gonna be left up to the workers that are affected by this, whether they buy it. But this is another instance in which they're using, it's a captive audience. They can put these things where the employees are gonna have to see it. They can distribute it via digital platforms like Slack to make it very much in your face if you're one of those employers. So I don't know, we're gonna have to see how it works out. I do agree with you though. About like specifically Wirecutter, I've used quite a bit. Some of their like the comparison things that they do is like countless hours of work that goes into that. I can't even conceive of it. Not to say that like look, everybody deserves the labor position that they want, but just specifically, I have a lot of history with Wirecutter. So anyway, that's my bias, I guess. And by the way, this sort of we jokingly made this initially about Wordle. The tech workers put out this tweet, which I just thought was absolutely awesome, with their own version of a Wordle daily thing with union voter and power right there. Are you a Wordler, Dan?
No, as with many of these social trends, I just get to see people doing it and I gawk and go, oh no, I'm above the sheep who fall for the social trends and choose to participate in the things that other people are doing for positive social interaction.
Producer Marissa just typed in Wordle sucks. Well, what Thank does you. It suck about? Anyway, I did it for a few days. I like words, I'm a writer, but it gives me like kind of the wrong mental strain. So I moved on after a little bit from doing it. I don't do it as regularly, but it doesn't bother me. Some people hate seeing Wordle tweets. I personally think any tweet that you see that's about someone's Wordle isn't any other tweet. So by comparison, it's gotta be good. You've muted Wordle on Twitter, that is going way too far. You might have missed some of this union stuff that made jokes about Wordle. Anyway, with that said, we're running out of time with our hour. I'm just gonna read a couple of comments before we go into our last story. Over on Twitch, thank you, Sunshine Dragon, for being a 12-month subscriber, saying Snowden, but so happy to be able to celebrate 1 year. We're glad to have you here. There were pitches for us to do more snow and weather related news. We'll consider it. Solidarity with the East Coast, I'll say that. I'm from Connecticut originally, so I understand your pain. Let's see, Susan Devine says your intro should be a cartoon with your super expensive app. I love the idea, I just can't afford it. Can't afford it. Anyway, with that said, let's jump into our last story with this video.
You talked about the potential, if it's appropriate, of pardoning some of the January 6ers.
Yeah.
Lindsey Graham said a couple days later, he thinks that's inappropriate. What do you think?
Well, Lindsey Graham's wrong. I mean, Lindsey's a nice guy, but he's a rhino. Lindsey's wrong. Look.
He's a nice guy, but he sucks. I hate his guts. He's a nice guy, but he's the worst. He's a rhino. Dan Evans. Has Lindsey Graham not paid for, like, he's paid his dues for Trump at this point? Doesn't he deserve some respect at long last?
Poor Lindsey Graham doesn't understand. This isn't the Republican Party. This is succession. Being nice gets you nothing. Sucking up gets you nowhere. I love the way Donald Trump, like, I don't miss him, but I love that, you know, Lindsey Graham, I love him, he's great, he's a rhino. Just go straight for like cutting him right there. It's so, he's a showman, what can I say? But yeah, to your point, John, there's no instance in which Donald Trump will not wake up one morning, take a look at the world around him and go, okay, these are the people I can use to further my goals. And then we'll wake up the next morning, look at the same people and go, nah, never mind. And people are dispensable to him, they're disposable. That's why you've had so many people turn on him and become pariahs in the Trump world because of that, is because they start to blow Donald Trump up on his act that he continues to repeat time and time again. And so obviously, I think Republicans know this and they calculate this. Ted Cruz knows that Donald Trump doesn't like him, but still tries to practice Trumpism wherever he can, because Republicans understand this, Democrats don't. Sometimes it's great, sometimes it's terrible. But if you just follow the guy who's going to get you into power, once you're in power, maybe he's gonna insult you, but you get the power you want anyways. You can do what you want. You can get your goals passed. Republicans do that for evil. Democrats could do that for good. These are just political strategies I'm throwing out there and talking about whether they work or not. But this is clearly what's like on the Republican side.
Well, so then specifically for Lindsey Graham, like he has occasionally been willing to criticize Donald Trump. I mean, that's what Donald Trump is alluding to. Graham had said that offering pardons for the January 6 people would be inappropriate. So that's criticism, but he's certainly been loyal for a very long time. So do you think he should be worried about the MAGA people turning on him? I mean, Rhino is, that's about as bad as you can be called in the Republican Party. That's what they call Liz Lynn Cheney, a rhino. So would you be worried if you were him?
No, the worst thing you can be called in the Republican Party is anything for a consecutive period of time. The reality is that the Republican Party has like short attention span. Their media ecosystem is built off of, look at this outrage, look at that outrage, look at this outrage, look at this. So until they pick an outrage to stick to, then no, they're not going to care. What happens is, like, this happened with Mitch McConnell right after January 6th, where he was saying, listen, this whole storming the Capitol thing wasn't all that good. I think Republicans might have to turn around and maybe abandon Trump or move on from Trump as a party. And that worked for all of 5 days. Like the New York Times was fooled. They wrote articles about it. They loved writing Mitch McConnell's finally going to turn on Trump articles, because that's like a liberal fantasy to them. But in reality, it doesn't happen. So same with Lindsey Graham. He sent out one of these like test ships to see, oh, what if we criticize Trump lightly? Let's test that boat out, see what happens. Oh, that boat got shot in the water. Never mind, we're not going to do that anymore. So this happens every couple of months. Trump signals what's going to happen if he continues it, and then they back off and go their separate ways. But as long as Trump doesn't continue to hammer this, Lindsey Graham won't continue to be hammered, and they'll be allies again the next RNC.
Yeah, and what is Lindsey Graham going to do? Let's say that Trump becomes president again in 2024, and let's say that he does make good on his promise to pardon them. I don't think he'd care about those individuals, but let's say that he did. What is Graham going to do? It's just a quote. It doesn't mean anything. Susan Collins said she voted to convict him. She just said that she would still consider supporting him in 2024. Like, so these criticisms are so non-consequential. Like, Trump freaks out because he's thin-skinned, but nothing would happen as a result of it. Anyway, I want to turn to a slightly different angle. Last weekend, Donald Trump said that he would consider pardoning the January 6th insurrectionists. I don't believe him. He has often said that he would support these people, and then he completely forgets about it immediately. But he said that he would do it, and then he has continued on in that vein throughout this week. Take a look at this video.
And some of these people are not guilty. Many of these people are not guilty. What they've done to these, and in many cases, patriots, their soldiers, their policemen, what they've done to them compared to what they've done to the other side. You know, you have to have equal justice, and this isn't equal.
No.
So I would absolutely be prepared. And Lindsey Graham doesn't know what the hell he's talking about if he says that, because you have to have equal justice. It's very, very unfair what's happened to this group of people.
Understood.
Okay, so he's pretending to care about the January 6th people, but this is not actually a video about the January 6th people. That is about the point that he just made, which you might have heard from right-wingers before, which is you can't have any consequences for the insurrectionists because they just let all of those people with the George Floyd and affiliated protests, they just let them go and there weren't any consequences. That's not true. That's very much the opposite of the truth. And I want to give you the numbers, because I'm not sure if we've on the show ever talked about these. We've talked about individual arrests and instances of police brutality during these protests, but I want to give you an idea of what actually happened. In the first 2 weeks of those protests, police arrested more than 17,000 people in the 50 largest cities. So that's not everyone that they arrested, that's just in the 50 biggest places. So they certainly did some arresting. Associated Press reviewed court documents of more than 300 cases that came as a result of those arrests. And they found that dozens of people charged had been convicted of serious crimes and sent to prison. They found more than 120 defendants across the United States had pleaded guilty or were convicted at trial of federal crimes, including rioting, arson, and conspiracy. More than 70 who've been sentenced so far have gotten an average of 27 months behind bars. 10 got sentences of more than 5 years or more. And while there have been people whose cases were dropped, that doesn't mean they were just released and that's it. If they got these, what are called deferred resolution agreements, they still had to do like stay out of trouble, not commit any crimes, do community service. They were still being watched and tracked by the justice system. So all of that has been erased by this idea that the only time the justice system has ever cared about protests is on January 6th, Dan.
Yeah, and then you see this other hypocrisy, which it doesn't matter when you point out hypocrisy from Donald Trump, but it does matter when it talks about people's rights actually being taken away, when they're being arrested, when they're being heavily watched, even if they have their complaints against them like being settled or like lowered for different things. This is a major issue. When you're comparing Donald Trump, who was talking about sending the National Guard into places, who actually had them come into I remember that one time there's a hostage situation with someone who they claimed was a member of Antifa, and then they had National Guard, whatever, shoot him in his house. That was,
jeez.
There's that situation, and then there's January 6th. So you can't apples to apples compare those.
Exactly. Well, you can't and be accurate. You can if you just want to make your base feel better, and that's why they've been doing it. Anyway, unfortunately, that's all the time we have in our first hour, but don't go anywhere because Dan isn't going anywhere, and you want more of him, you'll get it after this break. So if you're watching on Twitch, YouTube, the members app, we got more coming up. We're going to take a short little break, but we'll be back after this.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.